Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 27.
27.
Happy Saturday morning.
Happy Saturday morning. Happy Halloween Saturday.
Oh yeah, it's coming up. We're dressing up tonight.
We are. And I doubt you can guess what we're going to be, because it's a really strange thing. So I was looking at Pinterest, and I was like, oh, I should make deer antlers. And then I was like, I also would really like to wear glitter. So then we decided to be sci-fi deer.
Deer in the year 3000, to match the Halloween in the year 3000 theme that House of Yes is throwing tonight for the Halloween party.
Check out the Instagram to see what it looks like. In my head, it's going to look amazing.
It is going to look amazing. I've already seen your antlers.
Yeah. Mod Podge, paper mache, pipe cleaners. I made antlers.
And this is the second to last weekend of slumber in Brooklyn.
Yeah, second to last week. We've been pretty much sold out, except for Sundays.
So get your tickets for Sundays if you haven't
come. Go to Sunday. We still have tickets for next Saturday, too, which is rare.
Yeah.
So
it's because Sunday is selling really well next week, because Sunday is the last performance. Yeah. So that's selling really well. But we'd love to see you there if you haven't seen it. If you live in the tri-state area or even anywhere in New England, come on down. Come say hello to us. It's been awesome meeting some of you you guys at the end of shows. I'm glad people have taken us up on the opportunity to come find us, because we are always in the theater.
We are.
So for those of you who've said hello, hello back.
Yeah, yesterday we sat in the audience because we filmed it on our new 360 camera.
Our Nikon Key Mission 360 camera.
It's always nerve-wracking sitting like amongst the audience, because I don't want to hear anyone say anything mean. Luckily, they didn't. Everyone was loving it. It was a really great show last night. So
yeah, we recorded it in 360, and we're going to... We saw some of the test footage last night, and it looks super cool. We recorded the opening scene and the dance scene. I think we want to, before we release it to the public, change the angle, because one of the things about shooting 360 video is it's all about camera placement. So last night we were like, okay, let's try it from like the second row table. And we got a whole bunch of things that looked amazing and a few things that sort of looked hard to see because you're still sitting in the second row, not the first row.
Yeah, one dude's head was right in front of the camera.
But only at one angle, right? So if you, 320 degrees of the 360 degrees looked amazing. But we want to do it again where that remaining little window is a clear view, so that everybody can really feel like they're actually at the show, even if they can't be.
So hopefully we'll post that. Tomorrow?
The next day.
In the next week or two?
Yes, at some point.
At some point soon.
Keep track of it. We'll let you know on the podcast when it's up. But I also want to say thank you to everybody who's come out already, and also the response of beginning to the podcast. This month of October has been amazing as far as downloads and listeners and people who've jumped aboard the Hideaway podcast train. And shout out to those who are doing it from far away. We got an email this morning from Marina Reiger. I hope I'm saying your last name right. Who lives in Iceland. So we're getting some nice Icelandic downloads.
Worldwide podcasting. I know.
And, you know, our topics seem to be, staying in the news. Last week we talked about Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812 and some of the backstage drama that was going on. And some more news came out about it this week.
There was a lawsuit filed by Ars Nova, the nonprofit theater that started the show and the journey of Natasha Pierre, and they're suing the producers of the Broadway version for billing. It's all over billing. It's literally over billing.
And just to break this down for people who may not work in theater or circus business, all billing means is the way in which you're described in the show's program. So when you open the program, you flick to where your name is. The way in which they describe what your title is billing. That's it. Yeah. And what Ars Nova wanted and contractually apparently had, according to Ars Nova, was an Ars Nova production
of,
and that's what they wanted. And instead,
you have to be specific, because this is what they're suing over. The Ars Nova production of, and then it was dot, dot, dot. Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812.
And what do they have instead?
Instead, it says something like, originally commissioned, developed, and world premiered at Ars Nova, which to me is better and more truthful, descriptive than the Ars Nova production of. If I was an audience member and I was reading those two things, I would say, what is Ars Nova? Who are they? What is their production of? And if I read originally commissioned, developed, and world premiered at Ars Nova, I'd say, oh, it's a theater.
Yeah.
Well, let me look up Ars Nova. However, Ars Nova thinks the prior, that the production of Ars Nova, the
Ars Nova production
Ars
of.
Nova production of.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's odd to see this so publicly, but I just wanted to follow up on it since we talked about it last week. There was another really good article that I read that Ross Mollison, the producer of the circus company Spiegelworld, put on Facebook this week from the Washington Post, which is about the discontinuation. Is that a word? Discontinuation?
Yeah.
The ending of all elephants in Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey circus shows. And the writer stayed with the show for 2 months, and the last 2 months that the elephants were on the show, and observed and then wrote like a pretty long like feature about it. And there are a few really interesting takeaways that I want to point out from it. One's a Kenneth Feld quote. So Kenneth Feld is the current producer and owner of Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey. And they ask him, or this reporter asks him, how do you feel about, you know, no more circus shows? Yeah, no more elephants in your circus shows. And he had a really, really interesting answer. He said, circus is all about adaptation and all about change. And he pointed out, which I think I knew, but I want to repeat it here, is that Ringling is older than Coca-Cola and American baseball. And that the reason it still exists is because it has adapted and because it has changed. And I think circus is in a really, really interesting point right now. And I'm really excited to see the current Ringling show, which is all about, it's like a science fiction theme with ice and interplanetary travel, I think.
You know what I would love to do, I think would be really interesting, is doing basically like two case studies, one on Ringling and kind of pinpointing when they've pivoted for that, you know, business term, when they've pivoted their businesses and like evolved their show. And then look also at Big Apple Circus, which obviously was a much shorter lifespan.
Yeah.
But also just seeing kind of when they maybe stagnated and didn't change, when they maybe needed to. I think it would be like super interesting because they're both pretty, you know, started as traditional American circuses and touring in a tent. And then Ringling kind of went to this whole new landscape and Big Apple stayed.
It's interesting that you bring that up because I was reading Spectacle magazine this week. Cause they have a new issue. Spectacle is an online circus magazine written by Ernest Albrecht. And he tries to dissect what happened to Big Apple Circus and sort of break it down in the way you were just talking about.
Does he do a good job?
He does. I mean, he clearly feels very strongly about it. Mm. And it's definitely has an element of an opinion piece to it.
I'll have to read it. But he feels strongly about it in the way of what side?
He's just aligned with he loves Big Apple and loves what it was and is upset that it's no longer there and does a good job of explaining, I think, various reasons. Mm. I think he definitely is coming not from a business perspective, since I think the article doesn't really tackle too much of the
finances of it.
The literal finances of it. But he does get into it a little bit. And just jumping back to what you're talking about, comparing it to Ringling, just to point out for people who might not know the history of the company, it's pivoted a lot. It was originally started by four brothers in the 1870s or 1880s in Wisconsin, I believe. And over time, they bought out all the other big circus shows, including P.T. Barnum's show, which is why it's now called Ringling Brothers Barnum. And Barnum had also bought Bailey's circus show, which is why it's Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey. It's all four different circus shows that Ringling combined into one. And after World War II, the circus business was struggling a little bit, and they decided to take it out of the circus tent and into arenas, which was already the second generation of Ringling's running that. And one of the interesting things is that the person who suggested they go into arenas was Kenneth Feld's dad, who was a rock concert promoter who did all these arena things. And over time, they bought it, and it's been an arena since. But anybody who's a real circus historian can give you a better summary of what I just did. But circus is all about adaptation, and I think we've adapted it, you know, into something new.
Yeah, the best compliments that we get after the show are always when people are like, "I love the show. I have no idea how to explain it, but I loved it." I was like, "Great."
It is hard to explain. It's hard to explain because there's like real text, like a theater play, mm-hmm. and there's real dance, like a legit Just Dance show, and there's real circus, like a circus show. So I think people leave feeling like, what was that?
I know, and it's funny because when we are sitting in the audience and I hear people are like, "I think this is a dance show." I'm like, "Nope, it's not just a dance show." And people are like, I heard about this new, this is a new circus show. I'm like, "Yeah, that's true, but there's more." It's fun. It's fun to take all the things that we love.
If you don't have the chance to see Slumber while we're in New York City, don't worry. We are going to be in Australia, so you can fly out there and come see it. We're playing at the Adelaide Fringe Festival, which we announced last week on the podcast. We're playing in a 300-seat venue called the Menagerie, which is in a tent. So, you know, going back to the circus tent with Slumber. And it's going to be playing from February 16th through March 19th. Mm-hmm. So don't miss out.
With mostly the same cast.
Yeah, mostly almost entirely the same cast. Of course, we couldn't bring Anya and Melissa with us because they are permanent parts of the House of Yes. So they'll be staying in Brooklyn.
I think if we took Anya with us to Australia, the House of Yes staff would probably murder us.
Yes.
They would come find us and murder us with like glitter or something. But so on today's podcast, we had Olga Karmansky, who is one of my favorite people. She is in Slumber, and she is a jack of all trades, I would say. Although when I was introduced to her, as mainly a contortionist. But through hearing her life story, I realized she was so much more. Olga was ranked the number one national rhythmic gymnast in the U.S.
Yeah.
At 15. And then she transitioned at around 19 and decided she wanted to do performing and was on a national tour of Panic at the Disco, which Josh saw.
As a teenager in high school.
So worlds colliding.
Yeah.
And then she just was like, "You know what? I'll audition for this thing called Pippin," and was on Broadway. And she just is so cool.
And she was on Broadway while she was getting her bachelor's degree, which is
in psychology,
is no mean feat. And she has like a pretty amazing Instagram following. As far as like circus performers who listen to this, who are like, "How do I put myself out there?" Follow Olga Karmansky on Instagram and copy what she does. Like, she is the bomb at it. I think people are really going to enjoy this episode because we have so much interesting stuff about circus and the gymnastics and theater and Broadway in it. And Olga is a really, really compelling person.
Yeah. I think why it's been such a pleasure to work with Olga.
12:13 p.m.
Could you guys hear that? My computer just told us the time. I don't know.
Thanks,
why.
Thanks, computer. It's 12:13 for anyone who could hear that. But I think one of the reasons Olga's been such a joy to work with is she's so open and giving in rehearsal periods. Like, she just game to try.
Yeah, I mean, some performers, it's different for everybody, but you know, when you're rehearsing a scene without an audience there and you're doing it in a dance studio, it's very easy to give 50 or 60% of it because you're like, "Well, I'm not performing for anybody. I just want to make sure I hit all the major moments." But when we were rehearsing Slumber, Olga gave it like 100% from day one with no audience there and just mirrors in a dance studio. And she's really an amazing collaborator. So I'm excited that we get to share this interview with you.
So before you, well, you can listen to the podcast, but then after you listen to the podcast, make sure to like us on Facebook, Twitter, tweet us, Instagram, follow us, rate us on iTunes, email us at hello@hotawaycircus.com.
And come see Slumber. Only one weekend left.
I'm so sad, except I am very happy to not be cleaning the bloody laundry.
Every day.
There's a lot of blood in the show, and I clean it every show. So I'm very sad about the show ending, but happy to not be doing loads of laundry.
Amen.
So here is our interview with Olga.
So where did you grow up, Olga?
Where did I grow up? I grew up in Brooklyn. I really feel like I'm being listened to. It's so funny. I grew up in Brooklyn in Seagate.
Where is Seagate?
It's a gated community in Coney Island. Have I told you guys this already? Okay. So it feels like I'm not retelling the story to random people who aren't actually listening right now. So I grew up in Seagate in Coney Island. It's a gated community. I actually moved there when I was 14. My parents bought a house there.
Where'd you move from?
I lived in Kensington, okay. So not too far from here. And yeah, I trained in Canarsie, and my parents wanted to buy a house because they were immigrants and they finally made enough money too. And so they bought a house in that community. And I lived there for 2 years still, commuting. My parents drive me to practice in Canarsie. And then I left that gym because of a controversial situation.
Are you interested in the gymnastics training?
Yes. Sorry. Thank you.
Your parents immigrated from Russia.
Yeah.
How old were you when they immigrated? Or were you?
I was three.
Born three.
Why am I sweating right now? It's so it's funny. Okay. What's happening?
Don't be nervous. It's just
I don't know
a job
why.
And millions of people.
It's so interesting.
It's also hot in here because we have to turn the AC off.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's me, but did I put on deodorant? Yes, I did.
We can do the whole podcast in nude, and we'll just
Maybe I feel more comfortable that way. I don't know. Maybe because that would be stressful.
At least if Josh was naked, then we could all just be like, okay, great.
Oh, he's naked. Well,
we can
watch
it on a podcast that I'm just
we're
sitting
all
here naked.
Naked.
Yeah, we're all naked. We can't show you, but did your parents move to the States?
So we are Jewish and, there's a lot of persecution in the Soviet Union and, you couldn't, if you, you know, you didn't have many rights. If you wanted to be a doctor, if you wanted to be a lawyer, you weren't able to do anything you wanted really. And yeah, there's a lot of discrimination. So my mom said to my dad, I can't imagine raising a family here. We have to get out of here. And they, through this organization called NIANA, which was getting a lot of Soviet Jews out of the Soviet Union, we managed to get out. Yeah, it's crazy. Whoa. It's a crazy story.
How did your parents pick Brooklyn?
They had the option of choosing Australia, Israel, or New York, or maybe the West Coast as well. I think they had heard that they had some kind of distant relatives in New York. And so I guess it's kind of like rolling the dice. They didn't know what they were going to get. I mean, I think they had limited information about the outside world at all. And they had heard they had distant relatives there through this organization who had hunted them down. So they rolled the dice and picked New York.
Were they the ones who put you in rhythm gymnastics or did you choose that yourself?
Yeah, they put my brother and I into a lot of different things. I think at one point, for a short while, I did like art and swimming and this and that. I think it's very Russian to just put your child into a bunch of activities. Yeah. And then one by one, they kind of fell apart because I had limited interest, but also because my parents are immigrants and realized they didn't have the money to have me in all those activities. And then I just really loved rhythmic gymnastics. Like I wasn't considered particularly talented or anything. In fact, I was like known as just like that kid. Like that's there. Like what's she doing there? But I was just like, I just really love it and I couldn't get enough. And I don't know, I was really obsessed.
What did you love about it?
Like thinking back to when I'm like 8 and like the height of my obsession. I think it was the community, but I don't know. I just like really, I don't know. Just like a kid getting obsessed with it. I just couldn't get enough for some reason.
From the outside, the gymnastics seems such a brutal sport, like particularly on the person who's doing it, like you see these crazy photos of people doing hardcore flexibility training, but it's also sort of like juggling in a way because you gotta throw these things and catch them. But it was just always fun for you. It was never painful in a bad way.
We're not supposed to talk about negative things, but I will because I think it's a good thing to talk about, like the dark side of things. So from like 8 to okay. So I think I actually started when I was 5 and I started in a recreational program that wasn't very good. And then when I was 8, even though my mom wasn't into like having me be a professional rhythmic gymnast or anything, she was like, well, if you're doing this, you might as well do it at a place that has high level training. So she found this other coach that I went to. And she was really intense and is very Soviet style training. And I don't, it was like a weird thing because I loved it. and I loved doing it, but I wasn't particularly good. But like, I just loved trying to be good, I guess. I don't know. And, but there was definitely a lot of intensity, and my coach, was very abusive, like verbally and sometimes even physically. And I guess there was like, it kind of heightened the community amongst like my teammates and I, because we were like getting through this together.
What would she say to you?
Oof. this is some deep stuff. Just a lot of stuff about body stuff. Like everyone is fat, particularly me. You're fat, you're disgusting, you fat cow. Like,
does that still like affect you today?
I've done like a lot of work on myself so that I can live a normal life. but it took a while. It took a lot of like introspection and like deep reflection and work.
Well, it's like there's so much pressure on women to be a perfect body type, and then when you get that, because I got that not nearly probably as intensely as you did, but in dance,
yeah,
it was always like, you're too fat, like your butt is too big,
yeah,
and it really messes with you.
Oh yeah,
forever. And
yeah,
then you're like, I feel great, I feel beautiful, but there's always that little insecurity.
Well, I think as a kid, you expect the adults around you, they set the bar to like where you can like grow to, like they set that bar. So if they're setting it like, you're disgusting, you're fat, you're like, you just really identify with that.
Yeah.
You really believe it. You don't have the resources or the agency to be like, no, that's not me. That, you know, you just really start identifying that way. Mm-hmm. So you have to, yeah.
And tell me about how sort of your rhythmic gymnastics career grew and then eventually ended.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. When I was 14, it was probably like the peak of, well, I started getting good. And my coach, who's abusive, started paying more attention to me. And I had a lot of private lessons with her. So like I was just escalating, getting better. And at 14, I begged my parents to become homeschooled so that I could train like all day long, every day.
Did you not like going to a public school? Or?
I liked it. It was really, I went to Martin Junior High School here in Brooklyn, which is like a specialized school. And I was like in a dance program there and I really loved it. But it was really hard because I was traveling for competitions and then I would get sick a lot because I was doing my homework late at night, mm-hmm. like not getting enough sleep. And I still wasn't training as much as like the girls. There's really good teams in Chicago and Los Angeles, and they have access to like performing arts high schools and like, I don't know, their schools just let them out at like noon. And like New York City public schools just don't understand, you know, that you might have other interests or...
Yeah.
Other things going on outside of school. So they weren't very helpful or compliant. And so I was missing a lot of school and not training as much as the other girls on the national team. So I was just like, I want to do better in both. So I begged my parents to be homeschooled, and they really, for a long time, like weren't so sure because a lot of the other parents on our team were like, don't do it. She's going to be antisocial, blah, 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 all this stuff. And I just got my way. I begged and begged until they said, okay. And yeah. And then, so I started training 8 hours a day. And then, at 15, I became ranked number one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you ranked number one in the US?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's cool, but it's also, there's not that many people doing rhythmic gymnastics in the U.S. So it's like, oh, it's awesome, but it's like not that big of a deal. But yeah, I was traveling all over the U.S., but when you're number one, you're like the main representative internationally. So I traveled a bunch internationally.
Where'd you see?
You don't get to see much except the gym and a hotel, but I trained in Russia a lot and competed there in Moscow, Kiev, Bulgaria, Hungary, Germany, Japan as well, a lot of Europe, and there's a lot of Grand Prix and World Cups in France, so we went there like 2 to 3 times a year.
How's your Russian?
I don't know because I don't practice it, but it's there. Yeah. Yeah, it's my first language.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
How did your rhythmic gymnastics career sort of come to a close?
My mom had been kind of pushing me I was 19, and for the last year or so, she was like, she didn't see where I was going. You know, I was already of college age. And it's really hard to qualify to the Olympics coming from the U.S. because there's only 20 participants and you qualify from world championships. And the like more than half of those participants are from Eastern European countries and they dominate the sport. So like there's a very slim chance you're going to compete at the Olympics. And then even if you do, you don't get anything at the end. There's no prize money. There's no job opportunity. There's no scholarship.
Well, you're taxed. If you win a medal, you have to come back and pay tax on that.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Well, medaling was like not even like in the cards, but like if you compete, if you compete, like you really get nothing and you just like spend hours and hours training and yeah, just like spending. I mean, you have no life outside of it. So she had been like trying to kind of push me to like go to school or do something else, but like it's time to wrap this up. And I was kind of still pushing her. We were halfway through the Olympic cycle. I was trying to go for the 2008 Olympics. It was 2006. And then I was like, okay, I'm just going to give it like one big push. Like if I really, and I had already, all I'd been doing was like training. I don't know. There wasn't more that I could like dedicate myself, but I was like, I'm going to dedicate myself more than ever before. And I like stopped talking to like all my friends and like literally would just like go on jogs in the morning on my own, like do extra conditioning on the side, like train with my coach 4 hours in the morning solo and then have a group training at night and just like be really clean with my eating and just like was really at the peak of my like intensity. And then I went to this like the biggest World Cup in France. It's in Corbeil-Essonne. It's a little bit outside of Paris and it's every year. It's called like a mini world championship because there's like 150 participants maybe. So it's like even the world championships are every 2 years, this competition is every year. Mm-hmm. So it kind of gives you kind of a view into like what the world ranking is and where you kind of stand. And I think my first year when I went there when I was 14, I ranked like a record high for like a U.S. person competing for the first time. Because every year your ranking kind of improves. It's all very like subjective.
Yeah.
I had ranked like pretty high. I can't remember what my ranking was. And this was like my third or fourth or fifth year competing there. It was 2001. This was 2006. So it was like my fifth year competing there. And I was like in the best shape and I did really, really well. And I'd ranked the lowest like that I had ever ranked. And it was just so, and then I sat there watching finals the next day, which was like the top 15 people competing again. And like, I like knew that I should be there. Like mm-hmm. there's no question. I was just like, my mom was kind of right. Like, where is this going? Like, I'm not, it's just kind of hopeless. And a part of that was a lot of politics. And actually I've had like people who are involved in the politics of that later come to me and like apologize that there's just like all sorts of, what's the word I'm looking for? So Russia is always competing against Belarus, like the other Eastern European countries to try to rank number one and Ukraine and Belarus. And so they, and then there's like the countries that are just trying to be like top 15, top 20. So Russia will like come up to like the countries that are trying to get into the top 15, 20. And so they'll create alliances and say, make sure that we're number one ahead of Ukraine and the other countries, and we'll make sure you're in the top 15, 20 ahead of the other countries that are trying to be in the top 15, 20.
I've heard a similar thing about circus competitions from a few guests who've been judges mm-hmm. on panels, where certain countries will vote for one another's,
oh, yeah.
another's performers just yeah. to get them to medal, regardless yeah. of what they actually
yeah.
think.
Yeah. No, it's like, it's been, judges have gotten like suspended and red cards and yellow cards and like, yeah, because...
Wait, you can get red carded in midnight gymnastics.
Mm-hmm,
because you get red carded for...
So if you like, if they, cause they'll analyze the scores and they'll see like very clear alliances
yeah.
and they're like, you're obviously like manipulating.
Oh, the judges can get
the red judges carded. Get red carded.
Oh, but it's yeah. not like soccer or football or something where like, you know, one rhythm gymnast punches another one.
No. That'd be good. That's the next step. That's great. So yeah, that was kind of happening amongst the other countries, and the U.S. for the first time, for some reason, was like, no, we're not going to be involved in that, which is like, which they had been before. Mm-hmm. And for some reason now they were like, no.
So then they were like, you.
And so I would just like drop because there's all this other stuff like right. happening and my ranking would drop. And I was just like, I don't know, you're 19. I mean, it always felt like that when I first heard, you'd hear about this happening in international competitions from from the time I was 15 and it just felt helpless, but like you had hoped that something would change or improve. Mm-hmm. And then by 19, you're just like, what am I supposed to do here? Like, I'm this kid amongst all these adults, like playing these games, and they literally give each other like money and like Louis Vuitton purses. Like, it's very like out in the open. It's almost not even a secret.
So you come back to Brooklyn after doing that. Yeah. You're 19. You're like, oh, I don't really know about rhythmic gymnastics, my future in that anymore.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on internally for you?
Yeah, it really fucked me up. I was fucked up. Yeah, I knew earlier that I wanted to perform as a kid. I'd like watch like the Cats commercials and I'd be like, oh my God, I want to do that. Like, I need to be on Broadway, blah, blah, blah. I really want to perform. And I did some dancing in junior high school and stuff. But then for some reason at that moment I came back, I guess it was just like this quick, like sudden, like change that like at the moment things were changing, I forgot what I did know that I wanted to do after. And I just like lost myself, like complete loss of identity. And like I associated so much of my identity with what I did in this community and also like my body and what I looked like. And I gained weight. So like I just like everything was just like spinning out of control. Mm. And I just couldn't like get a grip. And it took me about like 2 to 3 years to like come back into myself.
What were you doing during those 2 or 3 years?
I actually think I did kind of was like, okay, I'm gonna like try to shake this off and like audition for things. And I got a tour during that time and it kind of put a pause on that transition. So I think, yeah, I was like 19. I like came back, was like lost, blah, 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 blah. And then went on some auditions and got a tour with Panic at the Disco.
Cool.
And went on a US tour with them, which was really life-changing and huge.
What year do you think you were on the Panic at the
Disco? It was 2006 on the Nothing Rhymes with Circus tour. You probably were there.
Oh
yeah.
God.
Yeah. Yeah. My best friend at the time, Sebastian, who introduced me to circus, I think we went to that Panic at the Disco concert and he came out to me as gay when we were like 14.
Whoa.
That was when you were driving to that concert?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And he's now
shivers. And then you maybe probably saw all
that. That's
guys.
So funny. Sorry. What city was that?
It would have been Hartford, maybe. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a cool tour.
What did you do on tour?
So I auditioned as like a dancer with like special skills. There was like a group of dancers. There's like 5, 6 of us. And everyone kind of had a unique skill outside of dancing. So there's a guy who did stilts. A guy and a girl who did stilts, a girl who's did point. I did ribbon and like contortion stuff. So we'd like backup dance for them, but then we'd have these little vignettes where we came out and like did our specialty thing too. It was really, really cool. And there were a bunch of other bands on tour with us, Plain White Tees, and Block Party was on tour with us for a while.
Yeah. Plain White Tees were open.
Cobra Starship was on tour with us. Yeah. For me, I was like out of homeschool, out of this like tunnel vision, like life, and like on this rock tour. And I was just like, what the fuck is happening? Am I allowed to curse?
Yeah.
Okay. Although my dad told me I'm not allowed to curse.
Oh.
Lindsay, I listened to the podcast and you don't need to swear.
He only listens for the first 10 minutes. Herb, if you're listening, let us know if you made it this far.
Wow, so you were what, 19? 20?
I was 19, yeah. And I was like, it was cool because it like kind of paused this like depression I was about to enter. Yeah. And it opened my eyes to like, I don't know, possibility of other lives because all the other dancers were like in their mid to late 20s and like they're from LA and like had this whole like artistic life, and I really connected with that. It was very special.
Any like crazy stories from the tour?
People just drinking all day long, like rock stars do, I guess.
I had like 3 weeks after the show at House of Yes. I'm like, I am tongue. I'm done. I can't even stay awake.
Yeah, people like have whiskey bottles in their hand at like 11 in the morning. We'd like arrive at the next venue.
So how were you exposed to circus? Were you exposed to it when you were a kid or really only after your rhythmic career?
It was after, yeah. So I knew I wanted to like act and dance. And the circus that I had been exposed to maybe was like on school trips to like, I don't know, like the Big Apple Circus. So yeah. I knew I didn't want to do circus like that. And Gypsy always criticizes people who do circus who don't like traditional circus. But I don't know, I didn't really connect to it. I connected with like, I don't know, shows that you could like, you transformed and it wasn't so presentational.
Was there a circus show that like sticks out to you in your mind of really like opening your mind to what it could be, or are you like, it was the first thing you liked?
I think Pippin was the first time that I realized circus was more than traditional circus and could be really used for storytelling and not just da-da's, which it had as well. But I didn't know of like the whole contemporary circus world really before that.
So how did you get into Pippin, and Pippin as in the Broadway version of Pippin, which I saw you at ART, and I saw Pippin on Broadway twice.
Yeah, I saw the day after opening on Broadway.
Yeah, I saw it in previews, and then
that's fun.
No.
So wait, you and I, Josh and I, have both been exposed to you prior to
multiple times. That
that's great.
Is that weird?
Maybe we even passed each other on the street and didn't even know.
I'm like, pretty girl.
Pippin, what was the question?
How did Pippin come about?
So at some point, as I was like grounding myself, I was like, oh, I do want to like get an education, but I know I want to perform. So I went to school and I went to BMCC, the community college here in New York, knowing that I wanted to transfer to NYU because they had a scholarship program. And I was freelancing and performing, and I was graduating from BMCC, and I had just found out that I got into NYU, and I had been hearing for the last few months, there's this audition and you should really audition for it, this show. And I'd heard of Pippin before, but I didn't really gauge that it was like this huge thing. And every time they had an audition, I was busy and I couldn't make it. And finally they're like, there's this last call like for this show. It was May and I just graduated and I knew I was going to NYU, and I was like, okay, I guess I'll go. Like, I just graduated the day before. I was like, I'll just do this thing. Like, I have nothing else to do today. Having no idea. I was like, came in super relaxed, like not caring, which I think is the best way, at least for me to be at an audition. And yeah, just like Gypsy led us through an improv, and I thought she was just like the coolest person ever. And that was really fun. I love improvs. And then I did like a piece of my contortion act and watched everybody else auditioning. Just kind of felt really calm and good and not really knowing what I was getting into. And then I got an offer, and then I had to decide between NYU and Pippin. And
the offer was for the Broadway
is
run?
For the work, ART? The ART, with like a possible Broadway run. So I was like, oh, I don't know. Like, these are two things that I've both wanted for so long. Like, both of my dreams are coming true at the same time. What do I do? I was like, okay, well, I can hold off NYU, and then like go, we'll see what happens with this workshop. So I decided to go do the workshop and hold off on NYU.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So tell me about Pippin. Like, what was that experience like? How was that show created? What was it like being on Broadway?
Yeah. The creation was like a little rough because it was all these worlds coming together, the, you know, the dancers and musical theater people and the circus, and we didn't understand them and they didn't understand us, and we work very, very differently. I'm thinking about like how we choreograph stuff in rhythmic gymnastics. It's also like very exploratory, like test things out, trial and error. And with dance, like someone comes in, like shows you the counts, you do them, you learn the counts, done.
Yeah.
Ask no questions, like do it the way you're supposed to do it. So that was like interesting, just like watching like your superiors try to coalesce, you know, right in front of you and just like stand patiently and like wait for everyone to like work it out and figure it out and try to be as useful as you can be. So that was a really good learning experience too, of just like seeing this like complicated situation, just trying to be the most useful you can be in the moment, and learning what is useful, like, sometimes speaking up isn't useful. Sometimes it really is. And just testing that out and learning that. It was just really eye-opening. It was the first time I really saw contemporary circus up close and personal. Working with all the acrobats was incredible because they're amazing artists outside of their athleticism. And that's kind of what I was and still am trying to continue to grow, because I have like all this athletic training, but like I want to continue growing my artistic side. So it's cool to see these people who are so high level physically, but also had a high level of artistry too. Yeah.
What was it like doing a Broadway show? How long were you with the production for?
I was with them. So I'm bad with dates. It started 2012. I believe I left Broadway 2014.
What's it like doing a show hundreds of times? Like, what's it like doing the 200th version of that show and the 300th version?
You go through, for me, it was like phases. So like the first 3 months, really awesome. And then I'd get into like a month funk where I was like, I cannot do this again. And I'd like fight and be like, hey, no, you can. Like, you can find something interesting and new tonight. You'll be fine. But it was like really rough. And then suddenly like break through this other wall and you're like, no, it's like fresh and new again. And I'm totally fine for like another 2-3 months. And again, you're like, oh my God, no, really? Like, I really can't do this ever again. Like, please, somebody stop this. And then again, you like break through the next wall and you're like, hey, no, it's fine. Like, I love doing this. But yeah, I don't know. When you like I loved everyone I worked with. And you have fun on stage and you have all your little games and things you're doing that nobody sees that you're doing, you're not supposed to be doing. So that always makes it interesting. We had a really fun backstage life that made everything more colorful.
Were you pursuing NYU while you were on?
And I was at NYU while I was there, and that really colored my whole experience. And I always felt really bad that, like, I don't know if I did. No, I always made it to rehearsal, but I don't know if like my stress of like trying to balance school with work was like rubbing off on other people. Cause I was definitely backstage, like like with a textbook, like highlighting and like just stressed out about balancing the two. It was rough. My NYU was not very supportive of, I don't know if the professors fully understood that I was like in a Broadway show. I tried to like explain it to them, but I don't think they cared because I was in the applied psychology program which is because there's two psychology programs and this one's like more intense and really for people who want to go get their PhDs in psychology. So because it's so specific, they're like, well, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? Then you don't belong here. But yeah, I mean, every kind of obstacle is another way to get stronger, I guess.
Totally.
Yeah. It was good. It's very challenging. All the students are they're 19, they're much younger than me, like 5-6 years younger than me, and very smart and academic oriented, and I was like trying to compete with them while doing this show. But the hardest part of it all is probably the lack of sleep. But you know, I guess once you get through that,
then you can handle it.
And then you graduated recently, right?
I graduated in May, and that was really exciting for me. Yeah.
Congrats on that too.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we met like the week before, the week after you graduated.
Because we were like, Olga, I'm putting the word audition in air quotes, but people can't see it. But we were like, can you audition for us? We were like, she's who we want. And you were like, oh, well, I'm doing finals right now. Like,
what happened even before that is we recorded the Gypsy podcast, which I think is episode 5. This will be episode 27, I think.
Oh my God.
She was like, so, like, how's Slumber going? Like, what are you working on? We're like, oh, yeah, we're just casting, you know, people in New York. And she's like, do you know Olga Karmanski?
Aw, Gypsy.
And I was like,
shout out to Gypsy.
I met her in the scene, but I don't really know her. And she was like, you have to meet her.
Aw.
And then we had coffee, and you came in all black. And I was like,
that's really funny.
Badass.
And I'm wearing black again.
Yeah, well, when I met you, my impression was like, okay, awesome. She seems like super game. I think she'd be fun to do the creation with. But I really thought you'd be, like, more like Anya, for lack of a better word, like
that's
more
so funny.
Like rough and tumble. First impression.
Yeah, that's really funny. That happened because I was so busy with school and the show that I was like, okay, I want to still look fashionable, but I don't want to overthink things, so I'm just going to buy all black stuff and wear all black.
Like my MO, I'm like, no one's going to say she wore all black.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, she's just wearing all black.
Yeah.
I get it.
But I think one of the most fun processes or parts of the Slumber creation for me was working on your number, which as like the director is probably the thing I'm the most proud of, because it's like it's a circus act that was just tricks that we really turned into like something totally new.
Yeah.
And I really do feel like it's new in comparison to just like contortion acts in general, particularly in New York, because the character is so clear and it really like it clearly moves the story along. There's like a little bit of text in it, there's some blood in it,
Keone
and Mari's choreography that they added to it is so awesome. You kill it when you do it. But I think, you know, listening to you talk about how the Pippin creation went with as far as like how do you combine the dance background and the circus background, that was one of the things I was most excited about Keone and Mari when they started doing it, and particularly when I saw them start working on your number, was their ability to write in the moment.
Yeah.
The circus, and I guess like you're saying with the gymnastics, is very much like, okay, here are the tricks, let's like do it a few times, let's fix this, let's fix that. While dance is much more like, okay, like here's Kyoni Mari's choreography, here's whoever's choreography.
Yeah.
Just learn it. And that process of being like, okay, can you just stay in that bridge for a little longer while we figure out what you can do with
right.
your hands
or yeah.
What you can do with your feet was a really cool experience.
Yeah, it was special for me because you guys came in with like, I think it's really hard for people to relate to a contortionist, right? They're like, I don't even know how your body moves that way. I don't know what you can do. I don't know. They feel, I don't know, confused us. I can't really explain what other people feel, but that's what I understand. And you just came in really confidently and like, yeah, so you can do this and this. And I don't know, you just had a whole vision for it. It was really incredible. Yeah.
Well, fortunately for me, I'd seen a lot of contortion acts over doing circus since I was like 12. And there are these just tropes about contortion acts that I just don't like at all. It was really only like part of yours, like one or two that I was like, man, that's really
which
like
ones?
Awesome. The Mystic Pixies act that mm-hmm. was in Kusa, which is three girls from San Francisco. And what that brought to like my understanding of contortion and what I was trying to bring to your act was speed. Like mm-hmm. the speed and the repetition and motion. Because mm-hmm. a lot of contortion acts are like, here's a pose I can hit, here's a pose mm-hmm. I can hit, here's a pose I can hit. And it's sort of like yeah. breaths between different mm-hmm. shapes. But what the Mystic Pixies did so well was like, the shapes are cool when you go in, out, mm-hmm. in, out of these shapes. Because mm-hmm. a lot of it is just like, oh my God, how did they get into that?
But yeah.
Just
yeah.
being in
well, every show when you put your shoe on the opening of the show and you do your, I don't know what that's called.
Back bend?
Chest stand.
It's not a back bend. It's like a full circle. But I love it because people are like, oh, she's going backwards. She's still going. And then you're putting your shoe on
yeah.
too. And it's like the first moment in the show where people are very much like, not taken aback, but I think
like,
the opening
circus.
Yeah, the opening number is such like a, like an image.
Yeah.
And then this is like this normal girl. And then
well,
you do this
thing. I
think
Summer goes from like that opening scene of feeling like almost like a Cirque du Soleil show or something. Like it's very abstract. And
yeah.
It's a dream sequence. To like basically a play where you have like a monologue and you do
yeah.
a contortion trick during a monologue.
Yeah.
And it's a real like strong juxtaposition that we
yeah.
didn't know we were going to have. But now I'm like, I would never change that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's so funny. It's good. It's nice to hear you guys talk about it because I'm so like in the moment. I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's great.
But now I'm like trying to see outside of it. And yeah.
The minute the cell phone goes off, the whole audience checks their phones. And then when you sit up and it's just like you talking to the light, they're like, oh, it's like a play. Like it's a really, you can
yeah.
see everybody's.
You know what the best compliment we got? It was last night. Someone came up to me and they were like, this show is so awesome. And I was like, oh, thanks. I'm really glad you like it. And they're like, I don't even know what it is. And I was like, amazing. Because they were like, it's not just circus. It's not just theater. It's not just dance. It's not just comedy. And I was like, yeah, it's, you know, we pulled from all of our favorite things. And
but I had no idea what a good actress and dancer.
I know, that's
be.
What I was about to say.
Like,
it's like, well, thank God you are so great at it. Because if and like Lisa and Bo and Lee, obviously Lee is an actress, but just the ability to play on stage and like vocalize. And Joran last night,
yeah,
like a stay here.
Wait, he did.
He inspired Joran to
that's
pull out.
That's great. Yes.
And his mom came up to me after one of the shows. He goes, it's so great seeing Joran do circus, but he's acting too. He's dancing. And I was like, no.
I know. But when we did the first, so there's a scene in the show where the second scene, all the girls sort of come over to one of their apartments, Olga's apartment, and they get ready before they go out to the nightclub. And originally the idea was to have no text and just do like dance choreography basically over it, which is no longer what we have at all. It's all text and very little dance choreography. But when I saw you doing the dance, it's sort of like girls doing their makeup in the mirror choreography. I was like, oh, snap. Like, Olga can really dance. Like, you could not tell between the three of you which one's
know.
Not
that's very
for.
Nice of you. I don't know. I felt it. I was like, okay, you really have to concentrate. Focus. Focus. Count to eight.
You can do it. I'd be counting out loud. I'd be like, one, two.
Yeah, because when you showed me their audition videos, I'm like,
yeah.
Oh my God, they're amazing. And then like, and then the first rehearsal where we like all like freestyle a little bit and they're just like ridiculous. And I'm just like super intimidated. Like, okay, you really.
And then you do your stuff and they're like, oh my God,
yeah.
I could never do that.
Kyoni
that was
Mari
also
were flipping
awesome.
Out when they
yeah.
saw your stuff for the first time.
Yeah, it's, you know what's great about this whole creation and this cast and show is everyone is really respectful and also very much inspired by each other
mm-hmm.
and inspired by the things that they can't do.
Mm-hmm.
and it's pushing people to do new things that they've been comfortable with. And like Kiyoni Mari choreographing a circus number was so hard for them in the sense that they wanted it to be the same counts every time. And it just like doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, so like, but then once they understood how it happened, they were like, oh, this is so cool.
Yeah.
And for us to be, and for you to be doing like real dance, and Melissa, you know, is loving doing the dance.
Yeah.
Is a really cool thing.
Yeah. I think they were perfect for this. They really brought in what circus need, even though like we can't do counts, I think they're so musical that, and circus performers are musical too, but not to this extent that it's really special to combine them with circus.
So you hit those musical moments every time.
It's like my goal. I'm like determined.
Everybody's come to you slumber just so they can see your act.
I really enjoy doing it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Are there any kinds of shows or a kind of act you want to do that's like on your bucket list? Like, I really want to do this thing or work for
this company. Josh will now write a show so you can do that.
Shit. I was walking over here being like, oh my God, what if they ask me what my favorite show is? Because I'm not like a list maker.
No,
yeah. And also like when I watch something, I'm so like in the moment enjoying it that I don't like then categorize it. Yeah. Or like think, the most recent thing that as I was walking here, I was thinking about it, that like really touched me was Hamilton. And I think it just like work that like touches people, you know, that like has a real emotional like catharsis or like makes people think or be more introspective. Because I think that's important.
Yes.
Yeah. So also, just things that have meaning and
So my thoughts about what I want to do with you.
Yeah.
At Slumber is to do an act where you have more text and we have to use a prop at some point. Like you have all these juggling skills that we, which maybe you wouldn't categorize as juggling skills, but it is in a way.
Just cause I don't categorize, but
Stay tuned for future Hideaway shows where
there's
an act that has way more text. And
I would love that. Oh my God. There's nothing I would love
when
more.
When you said to us in your, again, audition in air quotes, you're like, I really like acting and I really like talking, so if you can have any lines where I talk, that would be great. And I was like, in my head I was like,
I was like, I don't know what they're gonna say, but I'm just gonna put this out there.
I'm glad you're like, yes. And my head's like, well, I could go one of two ways. She could be amazing, she's been on Broadway, or it could be like some circus performers who really can't act.
You're
at
like,
all.
Oh no.
Yeah.
And you have to sort of work around that, but we got very lucky considering we didn't know acting, you know, portions of the auditions for any of the cast, considering what good actors they are.
We didn't think it was going to be much like text, but now there is, and it's great.
Yeah. But you were also recently doing a Shakespeare play, like nothing to do with circus, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said, like I originally thought I'd be acting and dancing, but like obviously my skill set is more inclined towards circus. But yeah, I did improv for like 3 years, with this group called the Yes Show. My improv coach and like director of the, it's like a workshop. It's like a 10 week workshop that has a show at the end. He's, the New York Lottery guy, Ralph Buckley.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I didn't know that until like 3 years into it. Like I heard his voice on the radio for the millionth time. And I was like, is that my improv coach? It's like the New York Lottery is now like $10 million. Yeah. He's amazing. And the group is amazing. That's kind of where I gained a lot of like, I'd say outside of my like contortion, like physical skills, like I learned so much there. And that really helped me at the Pippin audition and in the Pippin workshop of just like being able to like think in imaginary circumstances, like in the moment and being able to make decisions. So sorry, I totally veered off. What was the question?
I was gonna say, you should do a Shakespeare play. So it's not like your, we just get booked for acting now.
Yeah. It's exciting. I'd like to do more of that.
What play did you do?
I did, Much Ado About Nothing. I had a small role. I played Conrad and Messenger. Very small, but cool to watch. John Cariani from Something Rotten was in it. So cool. Really cool to work closely with him and watch him do his thing. You know, it's a new, still kind of a newish venture. I've had some experience. But yeah, I want to continue working with text and, just growing in that direction.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Another one of your insanely talented skills seems to be social media as well.
Oh, gosh.
If you don't already follow Olga on Instagram, you should
It's just Olga Karmansky, yeah.
Like, how did that grow into like a legit following?
Okay, so first of all, I'm very ashamed of this.
Why are you ashamed?
Yeah.
So, like, Josh and I literally every day are like, oh, Olga's so good at this. I wish we were like Olga.
I'm out of shame, just like not something I'm proud of that like I'm good at social media, but I am. I don't know, like even when I was a kid, I think I had a website when I was like 10 years old. Yeah, I called it Planet Rhythmic Gymnastics.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I don't know, I've just always like had fun with computers and the internet and social media. How did that grow? I think it was at a time where like a lot of yogis were like putting stuff up, and I'm kind of in the fitness world because I teach flexibility classes, and a lot of the instructors at Body and Pole where I teach were putting up like mini instructional videos or inspirational videos. So I like got on that boat, just like, yeah, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm training, learned how to like hashtag, and I don't know, yeah, just you start, people start following you. It's cool. A lot of my my private students that I teach found me on Instagram. Yeah.
That's amazing. It's amazing, yeah. To Kanemari. All of the teaching is found through YouTube and Instagram.
Yeah, yeah. I've been booked for workshops and private lessons. And I remember at Pippin, I guess Instagram wasn't that big yet, and I was Instagramming a lot, like, backstage, and I got teased a lot. And now everyone has, like, a huge social media account. I love it. It's really good. Like, it helps you book work, and it helps you get your stuff out there. And, you know, obviously I would love to be traditional and, you know, do things the traditional way, but why? Like, it's another resource. Yeah.
But also, you know, I think, like, I get what Gypsy's saying about you should like traditional theater or respect it or whatever.
Circus.
Oh, sorry, circus, yeah, traditional. We should go back to the Greek show. But I think when it gets, like, because I think when it gets hairy is when the traditional circus people don't want to adapt.
Yeah.
And like Big Apple Circus is a whole case study, really. But, you know, like adapting to the times and like adapting to the fact that there's social media and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And using it.
Yeah. Yeah. One same, grow with the times and learn to use.
That's how Josh casts almost always is through Instagram.
Yeah. Most of like almost everything I've been in, I think, is like has something to do with social media. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. I was talking to a few social media, like, I hate doing social media. Like, I don't want to do that at all. And their only video is private on Vimeo.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's cool. Like, I'm glad you want to, like, keep that all to yourself.
Yeah.
And your tricks so that when people see it, it feels super original. But,
right.
Definitely harder to book work that way.
Like, yeah.
You're not going to build a fan base by not talking to anybody.
Yeah.
So we're nearing the end of our time, but I do want to wrap up with the usual set of questions that we
do. Okay.
Is there a piece of advice you've gotten from somebody that's really stuck with you? A good or bad piece of advice?
It's hard to think of these things on the spot. I guess my own advice to myself, maybe.
That's good.
Yeah.
Just like continue. Like, I'm really big on introspection. I think I mentioned that earlier today. Just like knowing why you do the things you do, why you say the things you do, and like really looking inside of yourself and like learning about yourself, because then it'll make it easier to understand other people, work with other people, be other people if you're a performer. Create change. And then the other thing is fear, and like realizing when you're acting out of fear, or like avoiding things because you're scared, and like taking those risks and taking chances on things. Yeah.
That's very wise.
Thanks.
Yeah. I just really connected with everything you said. I feel like we were talking about this, anxiety and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But it's so interesting to me when I started like really looking at myself and why I was doing the things I was doing, it made our relationship so much better and able to work together. Mm-hmm. Like, we just created a whole show and lived together, and we...
It's incredible.
But I think it's so true. When you don't want to look at yourself and like why you're doing the things you're doing, you're just like not as good of a person to everyone else around you as when you are fully aware of your own insecurities, like great things, all who you are.
Yeah.
And like doing stuff out of fear.
Yeah.
Is a real thing.
Yeah. And it's just, it's not like you make the decision and then like it happened. It's like a constant, like daily, like thing. And like constantly like going outside of yourself and like looking at yourself.
You're
and
like, shit, like, I was a real bitch today.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Olga, thank you so much.
Thank you guys. Thanks. It was fun. It was okay. I survived. Yeah. I have a couple of white spots. It'll be fine.
That was our interview with Olga Karmansky.
I love her.
I do too. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please go on iTunes, rate us, subscribe to the podcast. You can follow us on Facebook or on Instagram. You can Twitter tweet us.
Twitter tweet.
You can email us at hello@howtowaitcircus.com with your questions or comments or guest suggestions. Mm-hmm. And come see Slumber at the House of Yes. You only have 6 more performances to catch before we go to Australia.
Seven
more performances.
There's 2 tomorrow.
2 tomorrow.
And tonight, but... it's pretty much sold out. So if you can come tonight, buy your ticket quick.
Tickets, yeah, tickets at the door too. As a podcast subscriber, if you use the code BLOOD, BLOOD at checkout, you can get 10% off your total ticket order.
Have a nice weekend. Have a safe and happy Halloween. And eat some pumpkin seeds.
Bye.
Bye.